Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In her work as a travel writer, Lori Erickson has specialized in pilgrimages to spiritual places. In her personal life, she has also been a spiritual traveler, trying out a number of different belief systems before finding her spiritual home. She shares the stories of her personal and professional travels in her new book, Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. She lives in Iowa City. In fact, she'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. And she is with me now. Hello, Lori.
Hello, Charity. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. And I want to go back. Let's start with your part of your personal spiritual journey. I want to go back to the church of your childhood. You grew up in Decorah, Iowa, which we all know is Norwegian territory. And you grew up in the Lutheran Church, which Garrison Keillor has taught all of us that Norwegians and the Lutheran Church go hand in hand. And actually, maybe we should just start with a little bit of a reading about the Lutheran Church of your youth. Would you read a little bit for us?
Sure. This is from Chapter 1, Among the Lutherans. The Lutheran Church of my childhood had definite ways of doing things that didn't have to be articulated because everyone knew what they were. Church suppers had to include white buns with a slice of ham and American cheese, plus an array of salads, as they were loosely termed, of various brilliant shades of jello. After school was out for the summer, we attended Vacation Bible School, which turbocharged our memorizing. I got extra praise for being able to recite all the books of the Bible, reeling them off so fast that no individual names could be distinguished. And after we graduated from high school, many of us went to Lutheran colleges, where we could find another Lutheran to marry, thus escaping the dreaded possibility of ending up in a hospital one day, trying to decide whether to kill ourselves or the baby. And as an aside, you'll have to read the book to get the context of that. In this world, being well-behaved was of paramount importance. I was, excessively so, earning good grades throughout my growing up years and pleasing my teachers so much that when I graduated from high school, I was named Girl Citizen, an honor voted upon by the faculty and given to one girl from each graduating class. There was a boy citizen, too, making us a matched set. I wasn't entirely sure why I received the honor, but I knew it had a lot to do with being nice to everyone all the time. I'd achieved the equivalent of Eagle Scout rank in being a good girl. As night follows day in summer spring, I, along with a good share of my graduating class, enrolled in Luther College. By then, my mother was working in the college's cafeteria, and one of the perks of the job was free tuition. I received an excellent education there, one that taught me how to read critically, write well, and learn for myself. Because it's a Lutheran school, we had chapel several days a week, and during those services and in my classes, I was introduced to a more mature form of the faith of my childhood. But looking back, I can see how Lutheranism never truly took root in me. Because it was in the very air I breathed from the time I was born, it never had any mystery for me. And a search for mystery is what would soon start me on a lifetime of spiritual journeying. Like a character in a fairy tale, I've had to journey far to discover the treasures hidden close to home.
Lori Erickson reading from her new book, Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. So, Lori, in your personal life, you said you never felt like you really fit with the Lutheran Church. And a lot of people, as they grow up, and they feel like maybe the church they've grown up in doesn't fit them, they just stop going to church. But you felt like you needed something. I mean, you felt like there was a real lack with, without that spiritual connection. Tell me more about that.
Well, first of all, I agree with you that a lot of people have conflicted relationships with whatever faith they grew up with. And for me, one of the benefits of writing this book and sort of picking up pieces of my past and looking at them again is to realize how much I'm still a Lutheran. That, you know, it sort of seeped into my bones in ways that I didn't think was there for a long time. But for me, I set out on a wandering spiritual path that went from the Lutherans. Next, I was a Wiccan, a neo-pagan, and then I was a Unitarian Universalist. Along the way, I've dabbled in Buddhism quite a bit. I eventually ended up back in Christianity and eventually became ordained as a deacon in the Episcopal Church, which
so is, not just back in Christianity, no, like, but all in.
Full, yes. Jump in the pool with both feet. Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And then when I thought I was completely settled, then realized, you know, I don't think I've ever been completely settled. And so there's some Native American influence in there, too, as well as a strong Buddhism influence. But I'm still a Christian, a somewhat unconventional one, I would say. But, yeah, so it's been a long and winding road.
Right. Yeah. So this spiritual journey that you're traveling, you also become a professional traveler, travel writer. Mm-hmm. And as you started exploring that career, tell me how you ended up specializing in pilgrimages to spiritual places.
Mm-hmm. In many ways, the two great passions of my life are travel and spirituality. And for a long time, I kept them separate. And at a certain point, I realized it was one of those duh moments. Well, actually, travel and spirituality have been linked for a long, long time. In fact, the first travel was almost certainly done for religious reasons. It would be the one reason why you would be willing to leave the safety of your home or your village. And so for me, it's been a very fruitful sort of specialty, in part because every corner of the world has holy sites. And they often are places that are personally interesting to me, but also places that really reveal the history of a place, the culture. They allow me to have conversations with people that go beyond the superficial. So it's been a very fruitful mix, that combination.
Now, in one of your chapters, you talk about the feeling that you get when you're at a spiritual site, which is part of how you define spiritual sites. But you also, we'll talk about some of the wide variety of places you've been on pilgrimages to. You also write about, for example, visiting Walden Pond and going to Henry David Thoreau's grave, which is a pilgrimage a lot of people go on, but I don't know that it would necessarily fall into that neat category of spiritual site. So what is your definition of a spiritual site?
Well, the short definition is a spiritual site is a place that makes my eyes tear up, which is somewhat imprecise, I know, but I know it when I feel it. I think one of the things I'm trying to do in my book is really to broaden that idea of holy site and pilgrimage, because I think a lot of people put it into a religious category and they think it's only for people who are sort of professionally religious or really devout. And I think instead that all of us have holy places. They are places that touch our hearts. They are places that we have. I think they're places where we want to be often silent. And I think that's a sign of the holy approaching, even if we wouldn't put it in those holy terms. So in my book, I travel to a lot of places, some of which would not be considered traditionally religious. As you say, Walden Pond is a good example of that.
Well, and let's talk about the definition of pilgrimage, too, because I think, you know, a lot of us, when we travel, we also go to special places. But how do you define the act of going on a pilgrimage?
Well, as with holy sites, I define it really broadly. And so I think a pilgrimage is a place that changes your heart in some way. And I think sometimes you know you're on a pilgrimage when you're on it, and sometimes you only realize it's a pilgrimage after you return home. I think a pilgrimage involves reflection in a way that an ordinary trip doesn't. And there's nothing wrong with ordinary travels. And, you know, sometimes what we need most is a mystery novel and a beach and a gin and tonic. But sometimes, I think especially at transition points, graduations, divorces, when we're grieving, when retirement is another common time for a pilgrimage, the road really calls to us in a different way.
You write about your experience, ironically, connecting with Martin Luther, even after you had left the Lutheran Church on one of these pilgrimages. And we're going to get to that conversation in just a moment. We have to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk a lot more in a few minutes. Lori Erickson is here. She is the author of Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. She'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Lori Erickson. She is a travel writer, and she has specialized in her career in pilgrimages to spiritual places all over the world. And her new book, she writes about those travels, but also about her personal spiritual journey as well. She lives in Iowa City. She's going to be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 7 p.m. The book is Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. And Lori, we talked earlier about growing up in the Lutheran Church in Decorah, Iowa, and how that just never quite felt like home to you spiritually. But you write about a trip that you took that took you to Wartburg Castle and gave you an opportunity to visit this spiritual place for many Lutherans and to really feel like you did connect with Martin Luther in a way that you never did when you were growing up. Tell me about your experience at Wartburg Castle.
Well, I went to the Martin Luther sites somewhat as a duty because as a specialist in spiritual travels, I knew that the big anniversary was coming up, the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's nailing of the 95 Theses to the church door, which is coming up at the end of October. And so it started out really as a duty and really became fascinating to me. I started to realize what complex and fascinating man he was. And so first it became sort of an intellectual puzzle, trying to figure out the contradictions in his life. But standing in the room at Wartburg Castle, where he had been essentially in exile, in hiding, and he translated the New Testament into German, which is a really revolutionary and dangerous act. And it was one of those moments when I unexpectedly found my eyes filling with tears, because I sort of felt the power of that act, even nearly 500 years later. So, yeah, I felt like I made my peace with Martin, and I can't say we're best friends, but we have an understanding now.
Well, and it gave you a really different perspective on mm-hmm. the religion mm-hmm. of your childhood. But it also, it felt for me in reading about it, it felt like a really important step for you as you began to understand spirituality, not just as the provenance of one church, mm-hmm. but a much broader world.
Mm-hmm. I actually think that's one of the things I'm most grateful for my travels around the world, that it is an interconnected story. These are not distinct traditions, that there's so many ways in which different faiths and different denominations have influenced each other, and characters turn up in similar places. And I love the way in which stories, you hear a hint of it here, and then you learn the rest of the story there. So, yeah, I take a very broad view of the power of spiritual places. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned going from Lutheranism to Wicca, which I know a lot of people don't know a lot about what it means to be a Wiccan. I mean, for you, it was much more about a connection with nature. But you mm-hmm. kind of struggled with that because you were on your own.
Right, right. So that was my spiritual but not religious period, several years. And I wanted to include that because I do think that's where many people are. And I don't think that I think it's a necessary stage, but I also think that it's often hard to have community. It's often hard during the times when you forget or you get disillusioned or you're just not there. And the value of an organized religion of whatever sort is that there are people who can carry you when you can't make the effort yourself.
Well, and speaking of feeling like you needed a community, a spiritual community. There's a very funny little part of your book, and I found it very funny. I don't know if everyone will, but why don't you read a little bit for us? As you were searching for a church, you write a little bit about the community of Iowa City as well. So read that for us.
Okay. In the progressive enclave of Iowa City, where the Church of the New York Times is the preferred option on Sunday mornings, various forms of faith are ranked from ghastly to acceptable as long as you aren't too enthusiastic. The list goes something like this. 10. Snake handlers. 9. Christian fundamentalists who don't believe in evolution and want to take over the U.S. government. 8. Jehovah's Witnesses. 7. Baptists, the Southern ones, as most people don't realize they come in other flavors. 6. Catholics. Their churches are a good place to go on Christmas to give the kids a cultural education. 5. Lutherans. They get a bump up because of the Garrison Keillor NPR connection. 4. Methodists. Good neighbors, and they're unlikely ever to bring up religion in your presence. 3. Unitarian Universalists. They'll marry and bury anyone. 2. Secular Jews. Engaging conversationalists. And number 1. Zen Buddhists. If a person is inexplicably interested in having a spiritual affiliation, this is as inoffensive as any. Clearly, the Buddhists were the coolest kids in the lunchroom. But an obstacle loomed large on my way to enlightenment, meditation, which I found to be the easiest thing in the world to do for about a minute, and after that, nearly impossible. I was hopeful for a while, thinking that the next new technique, book, or workshop would do the trick, and I could sit on a cushion for more than 5 minutes. Nothing worked. During this period, as I approached my 30s, I'd have latched on to indigenous spiritual traditions if even one of my ancestors hadn't been so intent on bonding with their fellow Norwegians and instead had married a Native American. For many years, I'd greatly admired Lakota culture in particular, thanks to our frequent travels to see Bob's family in South Dakota. But I knew how often non-Native people have appropriated their spiritual traditions without permission or cultural sensitivity. I didn't want to be a wannabe.
Laura Erickson reading from Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. And so you found a place with the Unitarian Universalists, mm-hmm. which was a really good church community for you for
absolutely.
Quite a long time. But you write about a crisis in your life, and it also became a spiritual crisis for you. Your very young son, Owen, became mm-hmm. very sick. I mean, in danger of dying, mm-hmm. a terrible mm-hmm. time for you. And you found that at that moment, you did not get what you needed mm-hmm. from your spiritual community. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that times of crisis are where your religious or your spiritual beliefs really are tested, of course, you know, whether it's your own serious illness or someone that you love especially. And so for me, as you said, it was my son's near death from meningitis, actually. And at the time, we had a wonderful Unitarian Universalist community, but it really was more secular humanist than it was spiritual at that time. It's changed now. And so I don't want to criticize them at all. But at the time, it wasn't enough to have a secular humanist response to that. I felt, as I write in the book, that our lives had really been touched by mystery as well as near tragedy. And I needed a way of trying to make meaning out of that. I didn't need a sort of facile theological explanation that it was God's will, what had happened, or that prayer had made all the difference. I wasn't looking for that. But I was looking for something more than, I'm sorry that this has happened. And so it was a turning point. But it took several years, actually, to leave the UUs, because it's a wonderful group in all sorts of ways.
Well, and you write a lot about the pain of leaving a church, which is something you've done more than once. Mm-hmm. What makes that so painful?
Well, I think a church, a good church, is a family. And families often irritate you, and you behave badly, they behave badly, but you still stick. But sometimes I think it is necessary to leave. And I think one way of looking at my book is Laurie leaves the Lutherans, then she leaves the pagans, then she leaves the UUs. Then she leaves this church, then she leaves that church. And so, you know, you could accuse me of being a bit of a gadfly, I guess. But the book also covers about 50 years. And so I don't think leaving is something to be done lightly, but sometimes I think that is what you're supposed to do.
Another one of your travels that took you on a spiritual journey, a spiritual pilgrimage, was to Lourdes in France. Tell me about that community.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lourdes is the best known healing shrine in the world. It's in southern France, and millions of people come there, mostly Roman Catholics, but not exclusively by any means. They come from around the world because Lourdes is associated with miraculous healing. Officially, the Catholic Church has designated, I think, 67 miracles, sort of medically documented people who inexplicably were cured. But I was very moved by Lourdes because Lourdes, more than any other religious site I have visited, belongs to the sick and the broken. And I think people were so honest about that there. And so you walk through the crowds and people are, you know, they're visibly suffering from all sorts of maladies. And I think a lot of us walk around and we don't, a lot of people, of course, have that everywhere, but we don't realize that. But at Lourdes, you were just part of this grand parade of the broken, and you didn't have to pretend in any way that you were anything other than a pilgrim.
You have a love for the shops in Lourdes. I mean, a lot of people are kind of offended by this kind of, knick-knack shop
that
grows up next to a spiritual place, but with every kind of candle, keychain, token that you can imagine. The Virgin Mary is everywhere. But you loved that. Why?
Well, it was a surprise to me because I actually don't like shopping, but I was fascinated by those shops in part because of just people watching there. That obviously people were buying those trinkets to take home with them. And that's what I was moved by, this idea that this cheap little plastic token that was probably manufactured somewhere in China was as full of the spirit of holiness, the spirit of Mary and of healing as a grand cathedral, and that those tokens would end up in people's pockets as they went into chemotherapy suites, and they would be passed down to people after someone had died. And so it was, you know, sort of seeing them in that larger context.
I realize I'm mixing up the timeline a little bit, but that sort of came upon you as you were trying to figure out where you belonged spiritually, as you have been many times in your life. But that was a part of the process of leaving the Unitarian Universalist Church, right?
Yes. I discovered that I really loved Mary and I love the saints. I love icons and I'm not naturally a Quaker or a Zen person. I like the color and ornamentation and the stories and the miracles and the myths and sort of all the glorious flowering of religious expression.
It's so interesting because a lot of what you rejected with the Lutheran Church were stories that you couldn't accept. Mm-hmm. But what ended up drawing you to the Episcopalian Church, which is next, what were the stories? Was the pageantry? Uh-huh. Was it that there wasn't enough mystery in the Lutheran Church? It was too matter of fact? Or what do you think?
Well, I think part of it was that I'd grown up Lutheran. If I'd grown up Methodist or if I'd grown up Catholic, I probably would have left those denominations too. And so part of it is this idea that I grew up with it, and so it just was too familiar. The Episcopal Church is a wonderful blend, I think, of Catholic and Protestant traditions. And the Episcopal Church has a great respect for individual conscience, and as well as liturgy and the beauty of the Eucharist, et cetera. And so it was a surprisingly good home, even though I felt like I was having to relearn a lot of what I thought I knew. Because what you learn when you're a child about your religion, it's not that it's wrong, it's just often incomplete. And I think that's why a lot of people give up too soon on traditions. You know, they don't really understand them. They don't understand what they're giving up.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm talking with Lori Erickson. She is the author of Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. She'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Lori Erickson. She is the author, most recently, of Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. As a travel writer, she has specialized in traveling to and writing about travel to spiritual places. She also has gone on a long personal spiritual journey that she shares very honestly and with a lot of humor in the book. She'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. And we were just talking before the break, Lori, about finding the Episcopalian Church, which does seem, after dabbling in Buddhism and Wicca, it seems like an odd destination. Mm-hmm. What drew you to the Episcopalian Church?
I think I was ready to have a tradition with long history, and a tradition that valued beautiful words. The Book of Common Prayer dates back centuries. It's been revised and updated, of course, but it has beautiful language. And I think as a writer, I really responded to that. I also discovered that I loved ritual. I loved not having to make everything up myself, to say words and prayers that have been polished over many centuries. And also I liked the freedom of thought of the Episcopalians, that they there's a lot of respect for individual conscience.
You talked earlier about really loving the saints and entering the world of Episcopalians. You kind of started meeting all of the saints in a new way.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I think one of the things that happens, I think, when you take a religious tradition seriously is that the people in the past really start to become real to you. And that can be people far in the past, like Columba in Ireland and Scotland, I write about in the book. St. Hildegard of Bingen, a 12th century mystic, who I feel like I could sit down and have a conversation with her. I feel like I know her so well. Also, more contemporary people like Thomas Merton, who is not officially a saint, but he should be. I think if you take spirituality seriously, time isn't quite as firm as you might believe, you know, that what happens in the past really is not just in the past. It's also happening now. And those stories are your stories because there's so many echoes. Like the spiritual journey, while it has many individual permutations, has classic elements of wandering, of discovery, of losing, of discovering again. And, you know, that cycle goes on again and again and again.
What made you decide that you wanted to become a deacon?
Part of it was, as a writer, my work was really solitary. And I really haven't always loved the research, of course, for travel writing. But a lot of my work is just spent in front of a computer. And I thought for a while of becoming ordained as a priest or pastor, and decided I didn't want to make it my profession. But the deacons in the Episcopal Church are generally volunteers, but they also are ordained, and so they have some, you know, they serve in liturgical ways as well. But I really became passionately interested in healing ministry. And so a big part of the book that we haven't talked about yet is actually Healing Touch, which is a form of complementary medicine that I became really fascinated by and helped integrate into the Episcopal churches
and,
I've been part of.
And you learned to become a practitioner of the Healing Touch yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Explain for us a little bit about how that works.
Well, Healing Touch is a form of complementary medicine. It's a type of energy technique, and it's similar to Reiki. A lot of people are familiar with that. It's used a lot in hospice settings, in hospitals. as an adjunct, not a replacement for medical care. And it also is very, very much in tune with the ancient traditions of laying on of hands for healing that have been part of faith traditions of many sorts for millennia, when we are in trouble, either in our souls or spirits or minds or our bodies, gentle touch can make a difference. And I found it was a way for me to sort of meditate through the back door, you know, that I've not been a dedicated meditator in any way. But I have always felt that doing healing touch allowed me to center and calm myself and in a sense to find a holy space in that context. You know, I didn't have to travel at all. I could just do a healing touch session, and that is holy space.
And you, as a practitioner of healing touch, you're not claiming that it heals illnesses, but it brings comfort and warmth and light mm-hmm. and love to
Absolutely.
People who are going through something difficult.
Absolutely, which is, of course, the classic description of prayer. You know, prayer also does not magically fix a broken leg, but healing touch can be a really, really valuable comfort for people. And one of the chapters, in fact, is about the 9-year battle with cancer of a dear friend, Rich Overfell, and how healing touch helped him and how it was an important part of our relationship. But he ended up dying. But that didn't mean that healing touch failed with him.
You also had the opportunity with him to be with him as mm-hmm. his life ended, to help in providing palliative care, to keep him as comfortable as possible mm-hmm. through his very painful journey, but also to provide the kind of support to his family that you didn't feel like you got when your son was in crisis.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it's nice to be able to learn from experiences and I'm so grateful the experience I had of our son being so ill, because I think that really was the foundation of my interest in healing ministry, that there's no substitute for going through it yourself, because you know what a difference it makes just for someone to be there, not what they say, not what they do, but that they're there.
You ended up changing churches again, but not leaving the Episcopalians, but moving to a different church. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on what makes a church community right for someone, because I think a lot of people search for that right fit without even necessarily knowing what they're looking for. It's just mm-hmm. going to feel right. But what do you think people look for? What do you need?
Well, most people probably aren't as they probably haven't wandered as much as I have, but I think a lot of people have left maybe once during their life to a different place. I think that is a mysterious question, actually. You know, mystery is a big theme in my book. And a lot of the most important things really can't be expressed in words, which is it's a disappointment to admit this as a writer, because I'm really confessing the inadequacy of my profession. But I think it's a gut feeling. It's a sense that your path is leading you somewhere else. I do think that it's not a step to be taken lightly. It is a family. But also, I do think wandering and journeying is a central part of a spiritual path. And sometimes you learn most by, you know, setting out on the road again, even though it's really hard.
You have traveled the world and gone to these spiritual places that represent spiritual places for many different belief systems. And it's obviously been very powerful for you. Most of us are never going to have that kind of opportunity mm-hmm. to travel around the world. But do you think that making a spiritual pilgrimage is an important experience that everyone should try to have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you don't have to travel very far, too. And I think that's really an important point to make, that every corner of Iowa, every corner of the world has a place where you can go on pilgrimage. It might be a retreat center. It might be a Catholic abbey. In Iowa, it might be Effigy Mounds, a beautiful, beautiful natural site, Native American holy site in northeast Iowa. The point is to go and to cut yourself off temporarily from your ordinary routines and to be in silence and prayer, if that's a word that you use. But I think prayer often is seen as something scary and regimented and something for people who are pious and are set in what they believe. And I think instead prayer really is an invitation to mystery and to openness and to silence.
I find it interesting that you had one of your greatest spiritual epiphanies at a moment when you were miserable, not because you were being tested or horrible things were happening in your life, but because you went to a retreat center and you had a bad experience. You didn't like it there. But you still had this moment of epiphany. And, you know, not everybody ever experiences a moment like that. How do you think you open yourself up to those possibilities?
I think you keep trying. I think that the spiritual path is work. It just doesn't come to you. And I think part of it is reading and part of it is travel and part of it is community. And so I'm a big believer in having a lot of tools in your toolkit. And so if icons work, go for it. Or if meditation does, or sitting in silence. And I think different things work at different times in people's life. So actually, I'm sort of getting into meditation now in a way that I haven't ever before. There's a line, I think it's from Pema Chodron. She said, the most important part of a spiritual path is simply to keep moving. So that would be my answer.
You also, I feel like in the end of the book, you at this point in your life feel like you can bring pieces of all of those different faiths that you've experienced, all of those different belief systems together.
Well, I think so. And I think that it's not that I put them into a blender and and it's all just sort of like this gray soup. But it's that those are all touchstones of inspiration for me. And so, you know, I think about Martin Luther more than I ever have in many years. And being on Bear Butte in South Dakota is a touchstone for me. And, you know, the full moon makes me think of my Wiccan days. And it's all a piece, and I don't think it's over either, but I consider myself extraordinarily fortunate to have had these experiences.
Well, Laura Erickson, thank you for sharing your journeys with us today.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be here.
Laura Erickson, she is the author most recently of Holy Rover, Journeys in Search of Mystery, Miracles, and God. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 7 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.